This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The cover story in this month's edition of National Geographic takes a deep dive into some of the major threats to the health of the Great Lakes. Within these pages, you'll find some very dramatic photos of massive algal blooms, surging floodwaters, and up-close portraits of species that are disrupting local ecosystems. We're speaking today with the writer and photographer behind the story. Tim Folger is a National Geographic contributing writer. He's also a contributing editor at Discover Magazine. Hi, Tim.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me today.
And Keith Ledzinski is also here. He's a photographer at Nat Geo as well as a filmmaker. Keith, good to have you with us.
Thanks, April. It's great to be here.
Tim, you write in the story that the Great Lakes might be the most precious resource in North America. I mean, that's not a hard sell here in Michigan, but I wondered why you chose those words. What makes them so important?
It's really hard to overstate just how valuable the Great Lakes are. They supply drinking water to something like 40 million people in Canada and the United States. They support a multi-billion dollar, sport fishing industry. Not just to mention just the life that the lake, the wildlife that the lakes sustain, and the commerce and just the sheer beauty of the place. This assignment was my real first exposure to the Great Lakes. I was this is a completely new subject for me. And it was just eye-opening that we have this region in our country that any other country, would kill to have. I can imagine Saudi Arabia would probably offer all their oil fields if they could have one of our Great Lakes, and we would be wise to turn them down.
How have the point sources for pollution changed for the Great Lakes? I mean, many people in this region are familiar with the history and the story of how the Great Lakes were redeemed and saved in the 1970s, and that some of that process brought unintended consequences. But what did you need people to know about the pollution map right now?
Algae blooms were a problem that we thought we had solved. They used to recur almost every summer, from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But then with the Clean Water Act, which, just started regulating the amounts of pollutants that could flow in from point sources like sewage treatment plants, algal blooms pretty much disappeared from the lakes until the mid-90s. Then they started reappearing, and now for at least the past decade, they've been happening almost every summer. So, so what happened? Why did they come back? And it's a combination of things. It's strangely enough, some practices that were intended to benefit the lakes have contributed to the resurgence of algal blooms. In the 1990s, farmers adopted this no-till agriculture where they reduced the amount of plowing that they did on their fields. And that was great in terms of reducing soil erosion. We need to preserve our topsoil, and this no-till agriculture does that. But paradoxically, plowing actually helps work fertilizer more deeply into the soil, which means that it's less likely to run off. But with no-till agriculture, farmers started broadcasting fertilizer on top of their fields, and it washes off more easily into the lakes. And there's kind of a double whammy going on too, with climate change is increasing the amount of heavy spring rainfall. And throughout the year, one of the effects of climate change is that we'll see more precipitation in terms of rainfall rather than snow. So with heavy spring rains, which are occurring basically at the same time that farmers are planting their fertilizer, you're getting all of this runoff into the lakes, which fuels algal blooms. The phosphorus is like sugar for algae.
Keith, this is where your superpowers come into play. You've got a couple of photos in the piece of a very vividly colored green algal bloom in Lake Erie. And the caption notes just how big it was. At its peak, this thing covered about 600 square miles. What was it like trying to capture an image of something so enormous and so destructive?
It was certainly an astonishing thing to see. And the big challenge is, I think, when you're dealing with something that is 600 square miles, that you need scale. You need something that communicates that. And a lot of the things I was setting out to do was to find little elements of, you know, where you could see where the green meets civilization, for instance, being one of the shots. You know, there's a picture that shows a little private dock within a small community on the shores of Lake Erie. And you can see this big green influx in the water right when it turns into residential. And, you know, I think that really shows how quickly we're being, you know, the effect that humans are undergoing with this. For the picture to be even more impactful, you needed that piece of scale, that something recognizable so the viewer could anchor into and say, wow, that's a boat. And this just goes on into infinity.
Yeah, you can see, like, this is why this is so desperately wrong. You also, there's another photo in which floodwaters are swirling through the town of Port Clinton in Ohio. They had experienced record lake levels in 2019, as many towns along the lakes have. What does the increased threat of flooding mean for the communities that you got a chance to see and interact with?
I mean, it's going to be, as Tim sort of had outlined, with this influx of rain being something that we're only going to continue to see more and more as heat index continues to rise. The unfortunate effect here is that all of these communities that live on the fringe of the lake, which is pretty much the most desirable real estate, is to be close to any one of these given lakes. You know, just last year alone, there was some $1 billion worth of damage. This is unfortunately just now a piece of what is to be expected. Climate change, all of this information that we've been warned about for some 30 plus years, we're now starting to see in real time taking place in areas like this. I mean, that is ground zero. And unfortunately, I don't think that there's really much of an end in sight here. It's really just going to come down to, you know, new construction efforts in order to combat this, which I don't even know it. It's just going to be an overwhelming situation. I wish I had a good answer to what that looks like, but seeing it firsthand, and I 2 years in a row, you know, I worked on this story over the expanse of 18 months as far as the photography was concerned. And that was a theme that you could see in any part of any given lake. There was flooding was just a part of it. And it's unfortunately just now a part of what living around the lakes will be.
My guests today are Keith Ledzinski and Tim Folger, the writing and photography team who reported this month's cover spread for National Geographic magazine, Saving the Great Lakes. I'm sorry to make you guys my doctors for aversion therapy, but I need to talk about the lampreys. I turned a page and came to the spread where you were documenting some endangered species. And you guys, these things are pretty intimidating. Keith, can you tell us what you learned about lampreys and the problems that they pose?
We actually went up to a facility where they study lampreys. And the people there could not have been more inviting and excited about lampreys, which is, it's so, you know, the unsung heroes, I think, are the biologists in the field and these people that are studying these big issues. They don't get a whole lot of press, and I think it's an easily overlooked position, but it's so critical. And what's interesting about the lampreys is that, you know, they came over as an invasive through barges. They, you know, I think you could find them in the St. Lawrence. But the lakes themselves, they weren't completely connected until the late 1800s when they were canaled out. And as soon as that happened, you know, the idea, of course, was to make this gigantic commerce route, which is to this day one of the great waterways of the world. The problem is by connecting these gigantic lakes, it allows anything to enter in pretty freely. And so once the lamprey started making its way in, it actually depleted trout populations from four of the five lakes, Superior being the only one that actually weathered the storm a little bit, and it's because of its depth. Well, these researchers were tasked to go in and figure out a solution to you know, tamp this problem down. And what they did was, you know, through vast amounts and years of studying, you know, these patterns as to where these lampreys would breed, they would go to these breeding areas, they would tag them all, they have them all pretty well documented now. And what they do is they take this specific type of poison that they leach into these breeding areas where these lampreys, you know, go and colonize to procreate. and what this is, and this has brought the invasive levels down tremendously, but it's something that needs to be constantly kept up on and done. However, if that were to stop, if we were to stop going to these breeding spawning areas, then they would begin to procreate again and start creating the same levels of damage. And that's something now they're worried about with Asian carp. It's already happening with these mussels that are depleting plankton and everything else. So the Great Lakes, as magnificent and special as this is, as an ecosystem, and it's, I mean, I think Tim put it so perfectly. It's one of our great, you know, the one of North America's greatest natural resources. This mismanagement is so unfortunate, and it's just going to be an uphill battle, I think, in perpetuity at this point, unless something dramatic happens.
It feels like that clarity of water has been such a double-edged sword, because people look and they think it's so beautiful here, it's so amazing, but it's actually a major problem. You know, one of the smaller species that people heard a lot about over the past 20 years is zebra mussels, and their feeding has filtered Lake Michigan to this gorgeous clarity. How would you rank the threats that they pose compared to the lamprey?
I mean, right now the mussels are probably one of the biggest threats that the lakes are experiencing, and it's just because these tube feeding mussels, they can siphon all of the nutrients out of the water, which of course at that low level, that plankton, you know, that it just affects everything above it on the food chain. And I think that is the biggest problem at hand right now. And I wish I had an idea of what that solution looks like. I know that it's being very, very looked into, because it's affecting the nutrients of the water. But I think that that's probably the biggest invasive issue right now happening in the lakes.
Yeah, despite all the problems that the Great Lakes face, and you know, and some of those problems are immense, there have been some success stories. The zebra and quagga mussels that Keith was talking about, they're just completely well established. That, you know, they number in the hundreds of trillions, and they've permanently altered the, you know, the characteristics of Lake Michigan, and you know, there's no going back from that. But the good news is that the invasion route that the mussels followed into the Great Lakes, that is, they came in the ballast water of ocean-going freighters from Europe. There are now really strict ballast water regulations in place. And one scientist told me that since those regulations have been in place, I think they went into effect in 2008, maybe 2007, over the last decade, there have been no new invasive species detected in ballast water. So that's fantastic that this major invasion route has been more or less completely shut down.
Keith, we've talked a little bit about how, you know, humans have had this pretty negative environmental impact on the Great Lakes, but you also included images of a young man diving into the lake against a sunset and picnickers enjoying themselves at Indiana Dunes National Park. Was it important, do you think, to notice what's positive and healthy about our relationship with the lakes?
Absolutely. I think there's still so much to celebrate and love about the lakes. Part of the story was to go and photograph these warm interactions and this culture that, you know, exists around Great Lakes. I mean, the Great Lakes culture is such a piece of the fabric of North America. I certainly grew to not only love the beauty of the places, but the people around them that inhabit it. And I mean, I think there's some 4 million residentially owned boats that inhabit the Great Lakes area. It's an astonishing number. And, you know, you go out in the warm time of year and the beaches are just filled with people, and, you know, it's their getaway, it's their respite. And I think that's what makes the health of the water something that it's just another reason to be deeply concerned about the, you know, we need a better Clean Water and Air Act. We need to definitely be taking this more serious and doing what we can. And the interesting thing about that picture you're referring to is, you know, it sits right along the shores of Gary, Indiana, and southern, you know, the southern Chicago and all the rest of it. And that area is so densely populated, but even still, it continues to have pollution issues. I mean, thousands upon thousands of people swim in these waters. It's such a densely populated area. Once that gets into the water system, I mean, it can freely flow wherever it wants. Tim wrote about accountability in his story, and I think that it's such a strong point. there needs to be greater repercussions for these sorts of things, because if there aren't these sort of accidental things that happen, a slap on the wrist just doesn't do it. There needs to be a greater accountability.
Tim, you write in the story that the immensity of the lakes really belies their fragility. And a Michigander who is also the editor-in-chief at National Geographic, Susan Goldberg, wrote an editorial noting that despite this huge role that the lakes play in our lives, you don't actually hear that much about how they're at risk compared with environmental problems in other parts of the world. Tim, why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. It might be just that we take them for granted, or we think that they're so large that they can't be harmed. But, you know, one day I was on a research vessel with some scientists and their students from the University of Minnesota at Duluth. We were on this ship called the Blue Heron. And we sailed out of sight of land, which is kind of an amazing thing to do on a lake, that you can't see the shore anymore. And it was this beautiful September day. And I was standing with a scientist at one point on the deck, and he was pointing to this big freighter off in the distance. The freighter was about 1,000 feet long. And the scientist said, you know, if you stood that freighter on its end to end so that its stern was resting on the bottom of Lake Superior, its bow at that point would break the surface of the lake, because the lake at that point was about 900 feet deep. That's really deep for a lake, but the lakes are so broad in extent, you know, several hundred miles, you know, east to west, north to south, just for Lake Superior alone, that their breadth is like, you know, 1,000 times more than their depth. So they're really like, you know, kind of like these thin sheets of water on the surface of the earth. And the scientist said, looking at the lakes in that way just shows how delicate they really are. And the lakes are also surprisingly young. You know, I was surprised to learn that they, even though they started to form at the end of the last ice age, 11,000 years ago, they didn't really take their current shape until about 3,000 years ago. So they're younger than the oldest Egyptian pyramids. And because they're younger, they haven't had a lot of time to develop the resilience and diversity of more mature ecosystems, say, like, you know, like the oceans or the Amazon rainforest. So, you know, they're very vulnerable to newcomers. Like an invader can come in, like the mussels that Keith was talking about, and just completely change the ecosystem. Lake Michigan's just permanently changed.
Tim Folger wrote, and Keith Ledzinski photographed the cover story for the December issue of National Geographic, Saving the Great Lakes. Tim, Keith, we really appreciate your work. Thanks for the beautiful spread, and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks very much, April.
Thanks for having us, April.